What is up, everybody? My name is John Sparks. I am your host for Sparks of the Paranormal. And I want to say a huge thank you to everybody out there that's been showing love and support on the Instagram, the Facebook page, all the podcasting platforms. You guys freaking rock, man. Seriously, thank you so much. And I think we're all really enjoying this journey together as we learn more about UFOs, cryptids, spirits, ghosts, demons, everything that goes bump in the night. And if you guys want to support the show, guess what? I just dropped merch. That's right. If you go to the Instagram page or you go to the Facebook page, you'll find a link there. It's going to get you some sweet, sweet paranormal swag. Maybe some dope hats, some wicked sweet t-shirts, maybe even a bandana for your paranormal pup. That's right. Grab a bandana, slap it on that pup. I want to see a picture on Instagram. With that being said, grab a seat, kids. Get ready, because it's about to get crazy on a brand new episode of Sparks of the Paranormal. Hey, what is up, everybody? Welcome back to the podcast. Welcome back to Sparks of the Paranormal. I am your host, John Sparks, and I want to say a huge thank you to everybody that listened to our last episode with Mr. Jonathan Turner from Exploration Unknown. I fell in love with his episodes, and I hope to one day be able to investigate with that man. Serious. Forgotten locations. So exciting. And he catches some insane stuff. But I am also super excited about today's episode, guys. I really am. This guy, you guys are going to recognize who I'm talking about here in just a second. But the guy's been doing paranormal research for 13 years. And he just, in May, had a movie come out that was made in part by Kendall and Vera Welton. I don't know if you guys remembered those names, but they were on a couple weeks ago. And I'm super excited to have this guy here. We're going to dig into some really cool stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. John Bullard. How are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic, and thank you for having me on the show.
No, dude, I really appreciate it. I really do. So let's go ahead and let's just dive right in, man. How did you get started in the realm of paranormal? Was it experience? Was it obsession? Or my personal favorite, were you a skeptic that's like, this is not happening and I'm going to prove it's not? Like, how did it go down?
So I think it started with experiences and then became obsession is what happened with me. Okay.
Beautiful.
So I would say around 10 years old, I was 10 or 11 years old. I was young. I would actually go, and I'm from Mississippi. My grandparents lived in Brookhaven, Mississippi, which is a very small town in Mississippi. And my grandfather owned a junkyard. So we actually used to go to older houses, antebellum homes, and he would pick up furniture, and he would do estate sales and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I remember going with him and helping him move furniture and stuff. And he was using me as child labor, basically. And yeah. And, but I remember going into some of these places, and when we would walk in, I would see shadows, and sometimes I would hear voices. Now, let me make it clear, I do not consider myself a medium. I think there's people out there who have a skill set, and I think it's fantastic. I also think there's people in the field who do not have that skill set, who claim to, and they ask leading questions. So, you know, it kind of muddles the field that we're in, to be honest with you. But I do consider myself is what I kind of coin what I do. And what I've kind of discovered is I call it a peek through the veil. So I would be able to hear people whispering and saying things to me. Now, I never told my grandfather what I experienced, and I never told anybody. And throughout the years, I would say from 10 or 11 years old all the way up to 15, 16, I would go to different places, different houses, and different locations, and I would experience stuff. And sometimes I'd walk into a place and feel like I had vertigo, like I'd be really dizzy. And that was kind of a sign that I would start experiencing stuff. And I never really understood what I experienced because it would be hit and miss. And I could go to the same place a couple times and I experienced it the first time, but I'd go again and I didn't experience it. So I just kind of wrote it off. Well, throughout the years, I just kind of wrote it off. And then I started kind of researching stuff online. And learning about the supernatural, the paranormal, and all that good stuff. And so I wanted to kind of validate what I experienced as a child. So in 2007, 2008, I decided I would go to King's Tavern, which is a very haunted location. Ghost Adventures have been there. John Zappas has been there with the Haunted Collector. Luckily, it was about 3 hours away from me. But I knew that that was a very authentic haunted location. That building is like late 1700s. So if you're talking about the United States, that's extremely old, you know.
It's fresh. It's fresh for the U.S.
It is fresh for the U.S. That is the best way to put it. So I got myself and a couple friends, who is a male and a female, Matthew and Kellen, and they decided to go with me. They were reluctant. They thought I was an idiot. So we had no idea what we were doing. I had an old voice recorder with a small little mini tape, you know, the old school ones that your parents had. Like when there was like the answer machines and stuff like that. We had a couple cameras. So anyway, we went in there and I went into the location with a total wrong mindset because I wanted something to happen so bad. So any creak, any noise, I was so excited about, but I really wanted to have something dramatic happen to just make me understand that what I experienced as a child, I wasn't crazy. Because I heard voices, I'd seen shadow figures, stuff has always kind of presented itself to me, and I didn't understand why. So that night while we were investigating, it was probably 2 or 3 hours into the investigation, we were at the top floor of King's Tavern, and all of a sudden the bathroom door just slammed shut out of nowhere. No breeze, it's in a small little doorway, scared the crap out of us, you know, and we just kind of froze. And then we actually caught a clear EVP of a little girl saying hello on one of our recorders. So after we reviewed that, it was kind of just this aha moment for me where I didn't feel crazy. I felt like it was validated. And I remember that instant moment, as bad as my memory is, I remember that time. And I just knew that what I experienced as a child, I wasn't crazy, and this was real. And ever since then, it's been kind of a journey for me. So actually, the male and the female who joined me that night, we did a almost 10-year stint, and I created my brand, Smoke and Mirrors Paranormal. And we went to locations, mainly historic, and our goal was to document evidence and make it easy for people to listen to, you know, stuff. Because if you think about the average person, everybody's attention span is very short, right? Yeah. Nobody's going to watch, and this is not a slight to people who do this, but I see paranormal groups sometimes who they'll do an investigation and they'll upload a video of like an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to watch that. You know, you have to understand that people want to be able to click and listen and move on. So what we did is we created a website where we uploaded our audio, we uploaded our videos, where they're very easy to listen to. We give descriptions of the video and audio, and they can listen and move on. So that's basically what my journey was for about a decade, was to just go to these haunted locations like Bliskak's Murder House. And we found some really cool locations that were known, and we went to some locations that were not as well known as well. Like Woodruff Fontaine, that's in Memphis, Tennessee, really cool place. And we were able to capture really clean, clear evidence, and people could rely and trust that what we were doing is authentic and real. We weren't falsifying anything, we weren't faking anything. And what's interesting about the paranormal, as you know, as an investigator yourself, is what we do is a painstaking journey, because it's not as sexy as what you see on TV.
Not at all.
Not at all. You know, you watch Ghost Nation, you watch Ghost Adventures, whatever, you watch a 45-minute episode, you know, depending on what they're doing, sometimes they'll film in a location 2 to 3 days, whereas in an investigation with what we do, it's one night. So even if you do one night, you have a DVR system, you have 4 or 5 recorders, that's a lot of evidence to review, whether it's audio,
a lot
video.
Of hours.
Yeah, a lot of hours put through it. And, you know, I don't trust a lot of people, so I only had 2 or 3 people that were reviewing stuff. And it took us a long time whenever we did an investigation to review everything, put it together, and then kind of clarify everything. So, you know, sometimes you go to 5 locations, and 4 out of 5, you get nothing. It's a lot of waste of time. But you enjoy what you're doing because you're on a journey, you're learning the history, and you're kind of gaining your skill set. Even if you go to a location and you don't capture evidence, you're still learning how to do EVP sessions better. You're still learning how to capture video you're debunking stuff. So you're gaining that skill set and becoming a better investigator every location, no matter what you get. Mm-hmm. But it's the small locations that you go to that you capture that Class A EVP, or you capture this anomaly, or you have something that actually moves, which is rare. You know, there's those small things that you'll remember throughout the years in the field that just stick with you and press forward. Because you can do 10 locations and only have one or two things happen, but those one or two things, you know, the one or two dramatic things that you have happen will continue to push you forward like the next 1 or 2 years, or at least that's how it is for me.
And I agree. I could agree with you on that, and especially when it comes to like the little known places, because, you know, I say it, you know, a lot. We have to remember that even though they're spirits and they're ghosts, they're still people, even in death. And when you have like a location like Waverly Hills, where obviously there's going to be a lot of stuff happen, it's just the way it is, but you've got people that are coming in there, they're asking the same questions constantly. You're constantly dealing with people, just from a dead person's point of view, you're constantly dealing with people, as opposed to these little known locations that there's nobody talking to these people. Well, I know that just in my own life, if I had to go, you know, even 3 days without talking to somebody, as much as I don't like people, I'm going to get super talkative. It's just going to happen. And I think the little known places tend to have a lot bigger stuff. That's something that I've seen in my research and everything.
I agree with you 100%. And that's why it's cool to be, it's kind of, we're blessed to be where I am in Mississippi with mm-hmm. Civil War and everything else that's happened. Mm-hmm. And you are 100% right. There's a place in Meridian, Mississippi, which is small town again, Mary Hope Mansion, and on the same property as F.W. Williams. Mm-hmm. But I think we were the first people to investigate F.W. Williams, which is a really beautiful house. One of the first houses in Mississippi to have an elevator in it.
That's cool.
Really cool. They actually had a lady who, she was elderly in a wheelchair, who wheeled into the elevator shaft, and the elevator was on the first floor. She thought it was on the second floor, and she did not die, but she was very badly hurt, and she later died in the hospital. So anyway, that was the house on the property. We weren't even investigating. We were doing the Mary Hope Mansion, which is a huge, beautiful mansion. Mm-hmm. But we went to the F.W. Williams house, and I said, hey, can we poke around in there? And she said, yeah, not a problem. And the stuff that happened in that house, dude. But, you know, here's what's interesting, though. So whenever you go into an investigation, and I'm so used to it now, so whenever we do tours that we'll talk about in a little while, the house in between house, mm-hmm. you're so used to when people come in to do tours, leading an EVP session and talking to the spirits and just having a casual conversation. But when we went into the F.W. Williams house, it's you go in there, and you don't want to intimidate, because I always think about if you're in there and say you died in the 20s, 30s, even 60s or 70s, and I'm coming in there with all these gadgets, you look like you're freaking, you know, look like a legit Ghostbuster, right? You
don't know what
all this stuff is. So I want anybody who's intelligent and has, you know, the ability to communicate with me, I want them to understand that I'm not trying to be aggressive. I'm not a threat. All I'm trying to do is communicate and have a casual conversation. And if they have something to say, they can definitely let me know. We can communicate back and forth. They can leave an imprint, even if I can't hear them real time. You know, we can play it back later. But when we went into Doug Williams' house and we kind of explained the equipment that we have and, you know, the recorders we have, all this, that, we got an EVP that said it happened. And what happened a few minutes before then was it sounded like a cannonball was pushed off a shelf in the house. There was a huge boom on the floor. We all froze. There was only three of us in there. We froze and ran to the end of the hallway. And there was only three rooms on the top floor, but there was nothing out of place. It was wild. Yeah. And then we got an EVP right after that and said it happened. But it was right after we explained, you know, you can make a noise, you can communicate with us. And we went through our whole spiel. But it was interesting that like something dramatic happened like that, and then we got this. It's kind of like if you've been running and you're out of breath, it was like it happened. So it's like they were kind of pushing the energy out to make something dramatic happen, and then we captured that it happened. So, like, if you put the pieces of the puzzle together, to me, that was interesting because this is a location that nobody's been in there specifically asking these questions to try to communicate, and then you have that dramatic thing happen, and then, you know, you get that recording.
That's just crazy. I mean, it pushes it off the shelf spiritually if, you know, you hear the sound. And then you're going through your spiel of like, you know, you can do whatever and blah. And he's like, dude, I just did.
Right.
He's like, God, stop talking. I did it.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, in the readings we got inside the house as well with the mail meter and some of the other stuff, the Eddie we got with vibrations. It was interesting to see the dramatic things we happened in this new location.
Yeah.
But then you go to some locations, like we've been to like Villisca is one of the places that I remember, and I had some really crazy stuff happen there, but it's just so hounded over and over again. You wonder and you question, you know, with that many people in there, if you go look at their calendar, I would say 365 days a year, I mean, 320 days, they're booked.
Yeah.
People inside the house. So, you know, do they get tired? Are they worn out? Because you have people who go there, and I've been there a few times, and, you know, I've been there where it's just totally quiet and dead. I've been there where it's just nuts and bananas. So, again, it's one of those things where we're trying to pinpoint the activity and understand the why for the what, but we can't say if you go to Villisca at 8 o'clock at night on the, you know, October 15th that you're going to see a full-body apparition. You can't pinpoint what's happening. We're just trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of research. You know, it's not a one night thing. Your first investigation, you're probably not going to catch anything. You might, but that's what the point of research and investigation is. I mean, how do you achieve research? Research, it takes time.
It does.
And you know, if you guys are out there listening, you know, John can tell you, you know, you have to take time. Don't get disheartened if you don't catch something. Let that fuel you to continue and to dig deeper, because that's, it may be your technique. It may have been the wrong time. There's a million different points to look at.
And look at the equipment that you're using too. You know, when I started 13 years ago, where we are now with equipment and what we use in the field today is totally different from what we had back when I first started. And it sounds crazy. I'm not saying I'm grandpa, but like, you know, technology moves fast. I mean, look at the iPhone, look what the iPhone and everything else we have now versus 10 years ago, totally different. And one of my big things is don't get over tech. Don't get too gadgety. Like use what you have in the field. But be smart about it. You know, I think one of the biggest things and one of the best things that and what I use is I love audio. So audio recordings are so interesting to me because even if you have a skeptic and you capture some clean, clear audio, you know, you need to have a really controlled environment in a professional investigation. You know, if you're doing a tour or a group session at a location that you paid tickets for, you're not going to be able to use that audio. You're doing those things more for the experience, right?
Yeah.
Instead of going for a steak dinner or going to see a movie, you go do a tour investigation and it's fun. But if you're going to do an actual true investigation, it's got to be controlled and you got to be, you know, on point. There can't be a foot shuffle. There can't be a sniffle. There can't be a whisper. And you can't control that when there's a group. You have to have your group in there to know exactly how you dictate an investigation to do it. But when you're recording audio, and I use analog and I use digital, and it's interesting because, like, you know, if you capture an EVP on your digital recorder, that's cool. Did you capture it on your analog as well? And if you didn't, why? Or if you captured it on analog but not on digital, why? So there's things that you have to ask questions about. So when you capture those EVPs and you get those class A's of like a full sentence or something that's like directly related to what you're doing, it's just so interesting to me. And we've captured those throughout the years. And even if you have a skeptic, and they don't believe, I totally respect that. But you have to dive into what that audio is, you know?
Yeah.
And if it's, even if it's not fake, then that's the open conversation. So that's why I'm a big audio person. You know, and the Mel meter and the Eddy and some of these other devices, they're great. You know, you look at like the K2 and stuff like that, and it's just so easily manipulated with cell phones and Wi-Fi and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can use it for a good bass reading, I guess, if you want to, but you really need to look into the equipment that you're using if you want to do a true investigation and understand the why for the what. Like, whatever device you're using, research it. Where did it come from? What's the basis of it? Why is it a paranormal instrument? You know, like, understand what you're using. Don't just use it because it's like, hey, I saw that on Ghost Adventures. Hey, I saw that on Ghost Nation. Like, know what you're using and why you're using it. You know, I think that's really important.
And when it comes to K2s, you know, I've always been a little leery, but because of how sensitive they can be. But they're coming out with technology now there's K2 meters out there that are, unless you sit your phone on top of it, it's not going to go off. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's the kind of stuff that you need to look at. You need to, I mean, once again, research, 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 research.
And then trial and error too, like you were saying about, you know, is a scientific experiment. So do your research and figure it out for yourself. And then you dive into like the spirit box, you know, like the SB7, SB11. I've never had any success with the SB11 myself. I've had success with the SB7. So when it comes to spirit box, and again, this is my personal experience, and I could be wrong. I'm just telling you how I think. I don't use it for the voices that come through. I understand the concept of what the SB7 is. What I have had success with the spirit box is I use it to agitate the energy in the location I'm at. So if you think about the spirit box, what noise does it make?
Irritating white noise.
Right. It's right. So I consider it like nails on a chalkboard. So if I'm in a location and it's kind of quiet and dead, I'm not getting any response, then we'll set up the spirit box and we'll get it going for a little bit. And it kind of static charges the energy. And I'll start to kind of get a heartbeat from the location. So that's what I use the spirit box for. I don't necessarily pay attention to what's coming through it. I do it as like the paddles, like you're trying to bring somebody back to life. That's good,
man. I mean, I know for sure that it would irritate a spirit because that sound irritates the crap out of me.
Right. Exactly. Right. So, but that's what I use it for. Yeah.
That's awesome. So, what are, other than the Mississippi house, what are some of your other favorite locations that you have been to in your years?
So one of my favorite locations, we actually got the opportunity to go to Jamaica, which is cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and you think about like New Orleans and like the South being like related to voodoo. Well, like Jamaica is like...
is voodoo.
Dude, they're like home with the voodoo. Like, it's like legit. So we did Rose Hall, which is the White Witch. So if you're not familiar with Rose Hall, go Google it and look it up. Obviously, it's a beautiful location. I think it used to be a sugarcane plantation. And the White Witch was a white woman, and she was very cruel to the slaves on the manor. And she actually used to have sex with the slaves. She would bring them up, have sex with them, and after she had sex with them, she would actually have some of them killed. She would have other slaves take them out and have them murdered. But she was very cruel to them, and it's very interesting. There's a lot of original antiques inside of the manor and the plantation, which is neat. And she's actually buried on the property. They have a tomb where she's buried on the property as well. What's neat there also is I like to capture and bring back haunted objects. I'm an idiot as well. So, but this is not a haunted object. But while we were doing the day tour, the lady who was kind of walking us through the house, showing us everything, she took us to her tomb, and she sung this really beautiful song and all this stuff. And I noticed a big piece of the White Witch's tomb was coming off. So, me, of course, I go ahead.
You
and
did
take
not.
It out. I did. I put it in my pocket. So I actually have it here now. It's one of my rocks, and there's crosses written all over her tombstone, and there was a little cross on the piece that I took. So I have a piece of the White Witch's tomb. So I have not died yet. There's no car accident. I could say this. I'm going to head and knock on wood here. And so anyway, that location was really neat because they don't offer a lot of investigators to close off and do investigations, but they gave us a 3-hour window at dusk, and we did a full investigation of Rose Hall, and we got some really cool audio, and we had some really interesting things happen. But just to be in that location and be able to investigate such a historic location was really neat. And Johnny Cash actually has a house not too far from Rose Hall.
Yeah.
And Ghost Adventures did a location there, and it was really neat. And they did an EVP session, and they called it an EVP, which sounded a lot like Johnny Cash, right? So what they did was they played a clip of Johnny Cash talking during an interview, and they did the vocal tone. Because, you know, what's interesting about EVP, and this goes back to me being an audio person, your vocal tone is very unique. It's like a fingerprint. So nobody's fingerprint is the same. Nobody's vocal tone is the same. So they did Johnny Cash's vocal tone, and they put it on a synthesizer so you could see it. And they played the EVP, and they put that over. They overlaid it on top of Johnny Cash's vocal tone.
No,
identical.
That really is cool, awesome. Yeah, so dude, the White Witch is living down the street from the Man in Black. That's awesome.
It's cool. So yeah. So like that's why, like you said, research and data. Like audio is always intriguing me because vocal tone is like a fingerprint, and if you can match that up to like relevance to whatever entity is supposed to be there. I mean, you have to have a conversation about that stuff. So that's really cool. And another location, everybody always asks me, like, what's the location that you'll never go back to? And I always say, Villiscax Murder House is one location that I'm not fired up about. And I hate it because it's such a well-known location. I sound like I'm, like, trying to sell tickets to it. But I've never had a night terror, I guess is what they call it.
Yeah.
We stayed the night in the house, and I've been there a couple times. And the first time I went there was in December. Now, why we went to Iowa in December, I don't know. I'm an idiot again. It was
nothing says Christmas like an axe murder house.
Right. So, but I fell asleep in the upstairs where the girls' room is, and I woke up just screaming in bloody terror. I was just drenched in sweat, and I don't remember anything. I just remember. The anxiety that I felt inside that house was like the only way I describe it, and this is a horrible analogy, but it's like if you're 15 or 16 years old and you got your girlfriend pregnant and you have to go tell her dad. Not fun.
Great analogy.
Right. That's how I felt inside the house the whole time. I actually only stayed in there for a few hours and I had to get out, and I went to the barn because it's separate from the house, you know. And I stayed out the rest of the night. So that's one location. If I felt that way every time I went to a location, I would not be in the paranormal.
Yeah.
So I had a really bad experience there, and I don't ever want to go back to Villiscax Murder House. So Rose Hall is cool. Villiscax Murder House sucks. So, Kurt John, don't go check that out. Yeah.
You heard it here, folks. Great times had by none. So that's insane though. So other than the massive night freak out, what else did you catch there?
We caught some crazy audio there. Herman, I think, is one of the child's name, or the kid's name that was murdered in the house. We got some really clear EVPs with that name called, and watching the audio and the video mainly, for some reason, there was 4 different videos inside the house that night where you see these light anomalies going straight into my head. So I don't know what to make of it, but it's like something was just like, if you're talking about a boxing match, I think they were like really going at me. I don't know what it was. I wasn't being aggressive. I wasn't you know, I'm very calm. I'm very relaxed. I'm never an aggressive person, but there was something definitely just focused on me that night, and it was coming at me. And to see the end result of what I felt, and then going back and backtracking, even to the day, like we were doing a walkthrough during the day, and usually in the daylight, you can't really see light anomalies. You know, that's why you do investigations. People ask why you do it at night. Obviously, it's more scary, but the night vision does pick up a lot more stuff that you can't see during the day. Yeah. But we had a lot of anomalies going into my back and my head, even like the first hour we were in there recording, doing some daylight stuff. So
I don't
know what to make of it. Yeah, it was one of the wildest things, and something that I've never been really attacked or, you know, we've captured growls. I've been scratched before, and that's a whole other subtopic. But I think that what was ever in the house that night was definitely focused on me, and it was relentless. And I mean, it took me a full week to recover being from there. I mean, I remember the drive back from Iowa to Mississippi, which sucks in general. Yeah. But just being totally just out. Like, I just wasn't myself for a couple of days. I was very, like, lethargic, depressed.
Paranormal hangover.
It was that times five, man. I don't know. I just, like I said, if that's what I experienced when I went to any location, I just couldn't do the field. Couldn't do it. Yeah. So I was not a fan of that at all.
Mm. So for the sake of people that are out there listening that have never done any type of paranormal investigating, can you give me a couple of major points for them that they need to know before stepping in to this field?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think there's so much more information out now because just the access of information, plus how many people are into the paranormal now because it's more well accepted. So you could definitely do your research. But I would understand whatever location you're going into, do your research. You know, I always had two different versions. You can go into a place blind and you could try to capture audio, video, then review your evidence and see if it matched up to what you read later on. But in my opinion, I like to do my research going into location to understand what you're going into and just have a clear mindset. I think just being able to be well-versed in what equipment you're using, what location you're going into, so you have a better expectation and a better outcome of what you get at the end result. Because like you said, I don't want somebody new into the field coming into it and just kind of just walking into a location because they heard it was cool, it's a famous place, they don't really know anything about the equipment, going in for 3 or 4 hours and not experiencing anything in the moment. And then when they review it, they don't get anything because it's all muddled. And then they're like, this is stupid, it's fake, this, that, and the other. So I don't want a bad concept or mindset going into the field. So take your time. I think this is a field of patience. Like you said, you know, it takes a while to get the results. But if you really do your due diligence with the equipment and researching the place you're going into, it'll be, you know, very rewarding. So this is a very rewarding field if you take the time to put your work into it.
Yeah. I agree, guys. Just, I mean, I say it in layman's terms all the time. Don't be dumb. Just don't be dumb.
Yeah. Well, and look, man, I've been on the field for 13 years, and I've seen a lot of people come into the field, and I've seen a lot of people who have nothing to do with it now. And it's not because they have something bad. It's just because they got bored. They just, they moved on. If you do it for the right reasons and take your time, and look, my biggest thing is the first time that you capture a true EVP or you have something really dramatic happen in front of you is a game changer. You will never forget it.
Use it. It's fuel.
So it's fuel, and be patient for it to happen.
Yeah.
And it's understandable that you go into locations excited for something to happen, but don't be overzealous. You know, just because something happens, don't, you know, we need it to be authentic, because when somebody fakes something or thinks something's paranormal that later becomes debunked, you know, we need people to be as authentic as we can in the field, because we're climbing an uphill battle because everybody thinks we're, you know, quacks and this, that, and the other. So
there's a huge difference between the paranormal and TikTok paranormal. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. But just be patient, man. I think that's the biggest thing is just be patient and just do your due diligence and research what you're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, let's shift to the topic that I'm pretty sure a lot of people are curious about, and that is the Mississippi House. How did you come across the house in between?
Yeah, for sure. So what you heard me talk about earlier, my favorite places, I did Rose Hall, Jamaica. I've done Bliskax, Murder House, Winchester House, Myrtles. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of historical places, and I did that selfishly because that's all I care about, because I experienced paranormal stuff as a child, so I wanted to go to the most haunted locations and research the history, and plus I love just being in old places. You know, when somebody will let you go into a mansion that's got like $3 million of furniture in there and let you poke around and investigate, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I didn't do a lot of private residence stuff. And the few private residence investigations that I did, I had pretty bad experiences. I was not smart the first couple times I went into a private residence. And what you have to understand is, you know, if you're dealing with a family or an individual that is going to allow you into their house, there's got to be something dramatic that's going on that they feel necessary enough to let you come in. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal thing for somebody to open up their home for you to come in to do an investigation. And I didn't realize that at the time, and I wasn't well-versed. And me and the two people who went with me to King's Tavern, who stuck with me for years, we went to a location on the coast of Mississippi one time, which was one of our first private residences. It was a single mother with two children. And we did a questionnaire, and we asked questions, and she seemed legit. So we got down there, and how dirty and nasty the house was, and how horrible the children were, I should have called child services.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bad situation.
Yeah.
So leaving that, that was probably 2 years after we did King's Tavern, so probably 2010 or so. I didn't want to do another private residence. We're off that, you know. Well, I had a friend that reached out and said they knew a nurse who was having some stuff happen in her house, and she was in Florence, Mississippi, which is only about 40 minutes from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, she's not that far. She's a nurse. Let's check it out. And we went, and I met Miss Alice. And from the first time I met her in the house, I could tell that, number one, she was genuinely scared. She was a professional lady. She was very intelligent. And being in the house the first, I think, couple hours, I actually had an experience myself. And I was like, I was like, she's not crazy. This is actually like a legitimate case. I was like, holy crap. So I was like, okay, cool. And the experience that I had, and I've only told a couple of people this, but while we were talking in her living room, I actually saw a black shadow figure go up the stairs, which I remember that I experienced as a child when I told you I used to go with my grandfather. It was the very same visual that I used to get when I was a small child. It was a black shadow figure, and I saw it move, and it just resonated and brought me back to my childhood, and I was like, holy crap. I was like, this is interesting. So I didn't tell Alice at the time. I actually didn't tell her until about a year ago that I experienced that within 2 hours inside the house. So I left, and I talked to my other two people that were with me. I was like, this is a legitimate case. We need to go into it. So we did a full investigation. We went in there. We set up a DVR system. We used our equipment. And sure enough, we got some really good audio inside the house. We actually had some things move. So anyway, it was very dramatic very quickly. So we kind of just spawned that relationship. And Alice is just such a nice lady, as you can see in the documentary if you watch The House in Between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's very sweet, she's very giving. So all I wanted to do was give her answers, because that's really what she wanted. She wanted to understand why what was happening.
Yeah.
Because she experienced stuff for years, but she never felt comfortable talking about it. And again, we're in Mississippi, you know, we're in the Bible Belt, we're in the South, so it's not like you just go out and tell people, hey, my house is haunted, I think I got alien lights in my house. I mean, you sound like a real weirdo, especially in Mississippi. So it was cool that she felt open enough to finally reach out to somebody, and I was there to help her and kind of open up that conversation. And then to be able to capture evidence on audio and on video to show her, hey, look at this, and to show you, hey, you're not crazy, this is actually happening, it opened up the door to kind of press forward. And I've done the house for, again, 13 years now, but we did the house for 4 or 5 years or longer before Brad Cooney came on, which is also in the documentary as well. What's neat about Brad joining the investigation is anytime you have a house or a location that's near you that you want to kind of dive into, you can do it, but it's also good to have a fresh set of eyes come in and take a different look at the house. Yeah. So for years, I did audio, I did video. And if you watch the documentary, you notice the chandelier is a big part of the documentary, as well as the ball of the stairs, right? Well, I did the house for years before I realized that the chandelier could actually be manipulated. It was about 3 or 4 years into the house. We were actually doing a random investigation. I was doing an EVP session in the house. And I remember all the lights were off in the house. The only light that was on was the chandelier, and it was kind of dim. It was myself and two investigators. And I asked if they missed Alice. You know, I said, do you miss the homeowner? You miss Alice being in the house and using her as a trigger name. All I remember was a shock to the back of my neck, almost like a dog collar, or you touch an electric fence or something like that. It shocked me.
Wow.
And I ended up on my knees on the floor, which is really dramatic. But I didn't realize at the time that the chandelier had actually drained at the exact same time that I got the shock to my back.
Wow.
So putting two and two together, first of all, the two people who were with me, who were with Smoke and Mirrors, they were with me for years, they were like wide-eyed, like owls. They were like, what the hell? What the crap just happened, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, they took the energy from the chandelier and transferred it to me and gave me a shock.
Dude.
Like, what's up? So it's one of those things where you're like, you never want it to happen again, but then you definitely want it to happen again, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, that was nuts. That's never happened before. Let's repeat that. So the chandelier inside the house, as you see in the documentary, is a twist on, twist off light.
Yeah.
So I'm like, let's try to do it again. And I remember that night we tried it several times and it never happened, and that's fine. So we have a DVR system that's set up in the house, and then we set up 4 additional cameras. So now we have 8 cameras. 4 of the cameras we can remote view, so we can watch on our phones. The other 4 we cannot. And I remember we would try to set up objects in the house to move. We'd have dolls, we'd have different stuff, whatever. And the chandelier would never go off. And finally, about 3 weeks later, we were inside the house investigating, and we tried it again. We were specifically asking for the chandelier to drain, if you can understand our voice, if you're here with us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the chandelier went off again. So it finally happened again. So what's interesting is, if we don't go to the house for 2 or 3 weeks or longer, the chandelier would never drain or never turn off. The chandelier would only turn off if we were in there actively investigating. So that was interesting.
Wow. So you could almost get it to happen on command. And when I say that, it's like being like, hey, guys, we're going to show up now. Let's party.
Yes.
And they're like, okay, let's party.
And then it became enough where Brad came in and he saw a news story in the house where he joined in, and we started investigating together. And yes, the chandelier, even in an investigation one night, we could get it to go off 3 or 4 times.
Wow.
While we were investigating, and we would play music, and that's another thing that I utilize also is music. I'm a big music person, and you know, you think about music, whether you're from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, whatever, and whether you speak German or British is English, sorry, whatever language you speak, you know, music is universal. So I always use music as therapy, as a relationship. And whenever we would play music, a lot of times the light would turn off, because I would say, hey, I'm going to turn this music off. If you enjoy this music, give us a sign. Shut the chandelier off if you want the music to continue. And the light would shut off a good amount of time. So it was interesting to see those direct responses. So then after the chandelier happened, As hokey as it sounds and as greedy, we got bored. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, so what else can we do? And by the way, you know, what you mentioned was be patient as an investigator. It may not happen quickly. I always give Brad a hard time because I'm like, you're such a butt because you came into your first investigation with the house in between, and this is what you get. Shut your mouth. I don't want to hear it. You walk into a gold mine. Whatever. So, yeah. He's got it easy. So we stopped doing the chandelier, even though we're still focused on a little bit. So we got a ball, and we had the stairway, which that's the first time I walked into Alice's house. We saw the shadow figure, right?
Mm-hmm.
That came up the stairs. And we've had some different mediums over the years coming in the house from California, from Seattle, and we didn't tell them the story behind the house. And a lot of people pegged a lot of activity up the stairwell. So I was like, okay, so let's focus on the stairway. So we got a ball, and we didn't want anything light. We wanted something heavy. So we decided to do a baseball. And the other reason we chose a baseball is because of the stitching on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So in our thought process is if this baseball is manipulated or moved, we can see the stitching move mm-hmm. with it, right? So it gives the focal point. So we set the ball on the stairs, and we started saying, hey, we really need you. And it's crazy because like we had these like really in-depth conversations with the entities in the house. And there's two dominant spirits that are in the house. There's a male and there's a female.
Mm-hmm.
There's Lily and there's Eric. Is that their names? Probably not. But that's the identity that we've given them. So that's the reaction that we're getting.
Okay.
And we've done a deep dive of the land. And you see a little bit of that in the documentary. And there's more to come on that. But there's definitely two intelligent spirits that I believe are in the house. And the reason I say that is I go back to my story of vocal tones and patterns. And the EVPs that we've captured over the years is the same male voice, which is very deep, and is the same female voice. Very, very identical. Very intelligent mm-hmm. responses. And there's also different entities that are in the house, which is interesting because we've had, I think, four different mediums in the house. And again, I told you, I think there's mediums that have abilities and mediums who don't have abilities. There's a couple in the house that I think are just incredible, and they are spot on, and I do trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've coined the house is a spirit hotel. They said there's a portal in the house, and the entities are coming there to gain their energy before they cross over.
Yeah, interesting. That is very interesting.
But I kind of relate to it, and it sounds crazy, but it's interesting when you go into the house because there's times where it's quiet, but it's still active, and there's times where you go in and it's like more active, and there's times where you go in and it's just like bonkers, like I can't stay here more than 2 hours and I'm kind of scared of the house.
Yeah.
So like it's and that's why it's kept my attention for over a decade, is because every time you walk into that house, you don't know what you're walking into. It's something new every time. Even though there's that baseline, there's still this whole other layer that you don't know what you're walking into. Anyway, yeah. So backtracking to the baseball and the stairs. So we set up the ball, and we wanted nothing more than the ball to roll down the stairs. That's what we wanted. We understand mm-hmm. it's dramatic, but that's what we wanted to happen. It took about a month and a half to 2 months, which in the scheme of things, if you think about it, doesn't seem like a long time. But if you think about us going in there pretty good, all you know, let's say we go in there 4 days out of a 7 day week, we're trying to get the ball to run down the stairs for 2 months. That's frustrating. Start to think that it's not going to happen, and you kind of keep going with it, and you just kind of roll the dice. But eventually, finally, if you watch the documentary, one of the first times that the ball rolled down the stairs, nobody was in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But if you watch the film, you see a light flutter, and you see kind of a dark mass move the stairway.
Yep.
And you see the ball rolling down the stairs. That's one of the first times the ball ever rolled down the stairs. And I'll never forget that moment. It was just absolutely incredible. And we did a backflip. It was the coolest thing in the world. You know, it's like going to Disney World while you're a kid, you know, riding a roller coaster. So the ball happened. It did what we wanted to do. It came down the stairs. Now the question is, can we replicate it? Can we get it to do it again?
Mm-hmm.
And how far back do we put it? Because we don't want to put the ball on the edge where a tremor or something else like that can affect it, you know. So we put the ball back, almost toward the very back of the stairs, and eventually it did it again.
Yeah.
And then it actually started happening where a few times it actually did it on command within 5 to 10 minutes of us asking it. So at that point, it becomes, okay, so I came into this house, we're building this relationship, which sounds crazy, but we're building the relationship to the intelligent entities in this house.
Yeah.
And they affected and you know, started messing with the chandelier. Now they're doing the baseball and they're giving us a response. I mean, it's almost like we're teaching the spirits in this house. And I know that sounds crazy, but
it doesn't because they're willing. I don't know. It's once again one of those things where when you don't have your story out, you want to get your story out, you know?
Right. And that happened, and I'm so glad that we have this documented, because it was a long process to do this. And what you see in the house in between is great and it's fantastic, but that's a lot of documentation over the years to see the blurps and the stuff that you get, whether it's the broom handle moving or the doll falling off the ledge of the stairs. There's a lot of things that happen in the house, but it's just so calculated, and we're working with the house so much that we are trying to manifest and kind of just bring this house to life and give this a story. So, you know, we're proud of the film and we're excited for the reaction of the film. And we are glad that we decided to take the scientific approach to where, you know, you see the people we bring in.
Yeah.
You have your physicist, you have the guy checking the level of the house, checking the electrical in the house. And we did that for a reason, because I think at the end of the day, Alice, myself, and Brad, we know how authentic this house is.
Yeah.
So we wanted to put it to the test. And that's why we decided to bring Steve in from Ghost Hunters Ghost Nation, because he has such an incredible track record in the field that, you know, we wanted him to come in and really just assess the house and see what he thought.
Yeah.
And this is a story we hadn't told a lot of people, but, you know, the first time he came down, which he doesn't fly because he has a phobia of flying.
Oh,
yeah. Down from up north, he had a direct reaction in the house. He left and then called Brad back a few days later and said, "Hey, this has perplexed me. I want to come back and I need to get back inside the house."
Yeah.
He had something else dramatic happen, and then that's kind of how it spawned the documentary. And this started as a small project. We didn't know how big it was going to get, but this is a story, which is Alice, that needed to be told. And I think the biggest thing for the house in between is this is a human interest piece about Alice and her story.
Mm-hmm.
And then we dove into the scientific aspect of the paranormal, and then finally we touched on the supernatural paranormal aspect of it.
Yeah.
And it is a different take, but I think that people who are really genuine in the field can really appreciate the direction that we took for the film.
Yes, 100%. I can agree with that. You know, we were talking, you know, I'm a production guy. You know, I am a paranormal person. I am a film person. And to be able to watch the adventure unfold and how the story was told was absolutely perfect. It was perfect. And I'm blown away, and I don't know if you can say this. If you can't, that's fine. But I hope there's a part two coming, because if there's not, I am going to be highly frustrated. Well, can you say anything? Can you?
That's put me on the spot right there. So, you know, we've definitely talked about it. Now, I'll tell you this. We are blown away by the success of the film. And what helps spawn a part two of any film or documentary is a success. So we definitely need people to continue to watch the film and stream the film, buy the film, and continue to ask those questions. But we left a lot of questions open because there's so much of the story to tell. And look, you can only fit so much into a documentary because there's a lot to dive into it. But I can say this, we're actively still investigating the house. Alice is still not living in the house, and there's a lot more story to tell. So we are very hopeful for a part two. And if everybody keeps pushing forward and screaming that we want a house in between part two, then I think that is a heartbeat that can definitely happen.
So with you heard it here, guys. You heard it here. So that is the House in Between is available on Amazon Prime right now. And I've got to tell you, if you have not seen it, you need to see it. I've already, like, I found out about it like a week or two ago, and I've already seen it like four or five times.
And that's what's cool about the House in Between too. Also, the House in Between, hopefully two coming, is that we hear so many people who watch it so many times, yeah. And there are things in the film that are called Easter eggs, which if you're familiar with, we don't highlight some of the paranormal stuff and the supernatural stuff. You gotta watch and see if you can pick up on the stuff. Which is what I love. One of my favorite directors, there's two favorite directors that I have. I have James Wan, who, if you're not familiar with James Wan, he did The Insidious and the original Conjuring, this, that, and the other. And then Mike Flanagan, who did The Haunting of Hill House, which is on Netflix. Mm-hmm. If you watch The Haunting of Hill House, there's so many things. If you don't watch in the corner, you won't notice the things. So our take is less is more. And this is not a jump scare documentary. We wanted to show human interest, scientific, and the supernatural, but we wanted to, we accidentally captured some paranormal stuff happened in the documentary. We didn't even highlight. We just wanted to capture and see yourself.
And there's a ton of those tiny moments. You know, you're focused on one thing, but there's something else going on. You got to look, you got to open your eyes, you got to pay attention, you've got to research, which is why I watch it so much. Because I'm always catching something. And guys, like I said, that's available on Amazon Prime. And as we're wrapping this up, John, can you give us all of your social medias wherever they can find you?
Yeah, for sure. So Facebook, just John Bullard. You'll see my cool photo. It looks like I'm professional with my leather jacket on. That's me. Instagram, John Bullard. It's very simple. JOHNBULLARD. And I don't promote my personal page a lot because I'm attached to the House in Between, and that's the project I'm doing right now. But earlier stuff that I've done, if you Google Smoke and Mirrors Paranormal, that's my group that I had for a decade. There's a lot of evidence that we've captured, audio, video, throughout the years. But check that out. But the biggest thing is go to thehouseinbetween.com. It'll tell you all 26 streaming platforms that you can find the documentary on. And the coolest thing is it's about to be Christmas. So check out the store. We have all kinds of cool merch. We got hoodies, we got shirts and all kinds of stuff. And I don't want to be biased, but we have some really good looking stuff. So go to the House in Between and check out our merch, man. Rock some gear and tag me in some photos. If you buy a hoodie or a shirt or something like that, tag me in it. I would love to see you wearing some House in Between gear.
I'm now that I know that it exists, you bet that I'm gonna have a freaking shirt or a hat or
dude,
even though I don't have stuff, a tree, I'll get an ornament.
I feel like I should get free stuff, but I don't. I just buy my own stuff because I like wearing it so much.
That's awesome. And speaking of merch, guys, there's new stuff in the Sparks of the Paranormal store, so go check it out. We just put out a new skeleton logo, and we also just put out a new Sasquatch logo. So go check those out. Go check out the House in Between. Go check out John Bullard. If guys, just see the movie. Like, there's nothing else that I can say. Just go see the movie. And I say this every time, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. When you're out there, you're following the House in Between, you're following John Bullard, you're following me. When you find people, no matter how big, no matter how small, in the paranormal community, show that love, show that support. We're all out here for the same reason, and that is to find answers. And with that being said, guys, I love you. We'll talk to you next time on Sparks of the Paranormal.